Hello and welcome to the Elastico podcast once more with me, Christopher Atkins. And this week, we're joined by Eduardo again from La Lambretta and Ravi, who you guys will know from Forza Football. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hello, Ravi.
Hey, Edu. Hey, Chris. How are you guys?
Great, thanks. It's great to have you guys on again. Obviously, we had you a couple of weeks back, and you're our go-to guys for the La Liga on the Elastico.
Thanks for having me back.
It's always a pleasure, and we enjoy always chatting with you.
So, obviously, La Liga finally got underway last weekend. Edu, what did you make of the first weekend's action?
Well, as you know, the first weekend was the second. The games were not scheduled in order, so we went to the second round of games, which changed the outlook that we had. We were waiting, of course, for that Betis-Sevilla game. That was part of the menu on the first week, and of course the Malaga-Barcelona game as well. And those two games were not played. So you know, it was a bit disappointing to me in many ways, because we saw the overwhelming dominance of Real Madrid, and then Barcelona on Monday. Unfortunately for Ravi's Villarreal, it was not a good night. Barcelona played very well, and I thought Villarreal didn't play particularly well that day. So those two things got combined for a 5-0 game, whereas Madrid was able to beat Zaragoza 0-6, right? So at away. Again, that doesn't hold well for Spanish football. Yeah, the other disappointing, I think, note for me was Bielsa's Atletico Bilbao did not play well at all. So, and it's a team that I wanted to see. My own Sporting Gijón lost at home against Real Sociedad. That was personally disappointing as well. But a Sporting, like many other teams that are going to be fighting for to stay in first division, fighting for relegation, they're going to have the same problem, which is goal scoring. So, not the start to the league, Chris, that we were hoping for. I think, I don't know if Robbie feels differently, but I was disappointed.
I think you hit on many good points, and I agree with a lot of them. Personally, I did not like the week because Villarreal lost, and as Edu pointed out, we played pretty poorly, one of our worst games in Camp Nou, because we normally play well at Camp Nou and had good results in the recent past. So, and then the rest of the week, I thought the Saturday games were good in general. Like, the Sporting game was interesting in the sense that Real Sociedad went ahead 2-0 with two great headers, and then which was least expected from the player Aguirreche. And then Sporting came back with a penalty, and they had it was 2-1 for about 15-20 minutes in the second half. It was a very good game. And then the best game, I thought, was due to Valencia's defensive issues, was Valencia Racing. Racing is one of the teams in administration, and they haven't spent a penny to buy a player this season. All the deals were loan deals. And they came to Mestalla, and they put up great fight. They gave up an early goal before even, I think, in the first 3 minutes. But they came back, and then they took the lead, and they led the game for until 88th minute, 3-1 or 3-2, and they gave up two goals in the last 2 minutes. So they lost to Valencia, but they gave a great fight. The Sunday's games were more boring in general, I thought. And the Madrid game was like a big sweep for Madrid, 0-6, and the best player for Zaragoza was the goalkeeper Roberto. So you can understand the level of dominance in that game.
Well, I watched a bit of that game, and yeah, as you said, it was pretty much a walkover for Real Madrid. Ronaldo was straight where he left off last season, another hat-trick for him. And I'm sure you guys have talked this to death in your podcasts and radio shows this week, but the gap between the top two and the rest looks ominously big. And I know from Sid Lowe on various podcasts this week, Sevilla's president has been quite outspoken on the matter. Well, do you think this is going to be a big issue for the league that they need to address as of now?
Well, they have a contract for the next 4 years, the current TV deal. So it's highly unlikely something gets done right now. Like, they will have to tear up this contract and write a new one. I doubt that's going to happen. So on the same lines, the Villarreal president, Fernando Roche, has also been very outspoken, but not in terms of such big words. But he has been also on the radios talking about it. I'm in the middle of translating one of his interviews to a radio station. I will post it. It's very interesting. He makes some great points. He brings up things like the reason why this league is like this right now is, for the past 5 years, Madrid and Barca have been getting about $120, $130, $140 million in the TV deal. And that has now reached a stage where they are definitely in a different league with the rest of the teams. If you compare, and he has a point, because if you compare the budget of Real Madrid in 2005, it was about $220 million. And the same thing, if you compare this budget in 2000 for Real Madrid, it was about $110 million. So that's what he's saying, that, you know, their budget is now close to $450, $500 million a year. And there is no way that teams, teams from number three to number seven, all of their budget put together is equal to what the budget of Barcelona is for last year, like $450 million. So it's hard to compete.
Edu, I know you had some interesting views on the matter.
Well, and I listened to the same interview with Paco Roig, with Francisco Roig, who is, by all accounts, one of the most savvy and respected presidents in La Liga. Not only does he, of course, handle Villarreal, but, of course, Villarreal B, it's a very successful side. And this is a wonderful story for Spanish football, the whole Villarreal program, a team that invests heavily in their training facility, a team that is fiscally conservative and responsible. As you know, Villarreal sold Santi Cazorla for essentially 20 million euros to Malaga. And he did so, according to his own words, to be able to balance his budget, his books. On a side note, I found out today, and I don't know if Robbie has confirmed this, there were rumors that Santi Cazorla and Villarreal actually had a deal in place with Arsenal. And that Arsenal, according to the reports that I've read, did not act quickly enough, and Malaga showed up with the old ubiquitous money bag. And so I don't know if that's true, but in essence, you know, the gentleman is trying to act responsibly, and he feels that he's in an untenable situation, right? So there are teams who are under administration, such as Racing, like Robbie pointed out, that are still spending money. And they may not be doing so directly. They might be doing it through third parties, where the rights of the player are actually held by the president of the team and a, you know, company, or some kind of arrangement where teams are actually still spending money, because they still have to pay those salaries. And so it's a very difficult situation. I think one of the problems that I have, there are very few figures like Paco Roig in Spain. And when we look at the president of Sevilla, Del Nido, as somebody who's going to give ethical lessons, I have a problem with that. So it's a difficult situation. And of course, nobody wants to, especially Real Madrid and Barcelona, they're not going to easily give up this position of power. You know, and so at the end of the day, there has to be a decision in Spanish football. Are we going to continue to be a national league, or are teams like Barcelona and Real Madrid going to move on and say, we're going to play a European league and we're going to let other teams play the national league? I think that would be a possibility, some kind of compromise. That's not the compromise that I would like, but I see it almost impossible for teams like Barcelona and Real Madrid to give up the money that they have now. I would like to see a system where the money is spread out. I'm not sure if the EPL system is the right one for Spain, but something like that, you know, where money is distributed and teams in the bottom have a chance, especially teams that have been in the first division 5-6 years, that they've demonstrated that they're responsible financially. They're not overspending. They're not spending over their means, and that they're trying to, you know, to make their system work, create a base from their youth programs. Those kinds of things, like Villarreal have done. You know, it makes it a lot easier when people like Paco Roig argue the point. The other, and Robbie, there's an anecdote from the interview where he chastised the president of the association, Astiazaran, for having found out the schedules of the games on a newspaper. When in this case was Marca, and he said, you know, I don't want this to happen again. And so he says, and he was true to his word. I didn't find out from Marca next time. I found out from AS, the other ace, in English, the other sort of big newspaper in Spain. So, you know, when you have that kind of leadership in La Liga, it's very difficult to be positive. And I think it's going to be almost an impossible project to try to shake things up. On a side note, Chris, I know I mentioned it to you off the air that there's an issue with radio stations in Spain. It's all part of this big issue of lack of accountability for team presidents, that they can do all kinds of crooked things, let's just say it like that, and that at the end of the day, there is nothing to hold them accountable. And that is it's a sad state of affairs for a league that is supposed to be the greatest league in the world and that has the greatest players. I think in those terms, the EPL is it's a much better league. The way it is professionally structured, I think it's a much more serious enterprise than La Liga.
Which is why it surprises me then that, for example, I'm going to be talking the Brazilian league with Robert later, and Brazil has chosen to go the way of the Spanish TV rights deal, which strikes me as ridiculous when they can analyze the different deals from across Europe and pick how they're going to structure it. So in Brazil, they're going to have Flamengo and Corinthians getting substantially more than anyone else. And you would think they'd have looked at the situation with the player strike, which was in a way related to this. Of course, there was the Ley Concursal as well. But it seems to me odd that they'd have chosen to go down that route. Ravi, last time you were on, we discussed, obviously, the player strike that was going to take place. What was the outcome in that case? And should the players have pushed more for accountability from the clubs rather than just their own personal guarantee of salaries?
Well, it's not even what they got from the strike. I don't even know what they exactly got from it, because I think what they got is now a bigger, slightly bigger amount of insurance for their players. And I think that's all they got. And there is still no guarantee on whether all their dues will be paid in a given period of time. So it was kind of it was a strike, but then there was teams playing in Europe, playing like Villarreal, Sevilla, Athletic and Atletico. They were all playing their games. They were practicing. Madrid played their Barcelona played their annual Gamper, which is like the presentation of the team at the Camp Nou exhibition game against Napoli. So it was a midway strike, I would say, and they also got results the same way. What they got is not probably what they wanted.
Well, yeah, in legal terms, it wasn't really a strike because they were still collecting their wages, I guess. But that issue aside, they seem to have kind of struck a compromise that gets them off the club's backs, but doesn't really sort out the issues as a whole.
No, I was saying they didn't. In my opinion, they didn't really gain much from the strike, and it was just a huge loss of prestige around the world that these guys cannot resolve their things up in advance.
Well, Serie A now has a big problem with a strike that seems to be more severe in terms of. You even have club presidents talking this could go on for months, which is worrying. I don't know if either of you have picked up on that point.
Well, as you know, Chris, the economic problems that are affecting Spain are quite similar to the ones that are affecting Italy. These things permeate, of course, through society, and clubs are not immune to these things, especially when they're run the way they are in Spain and in many cases in Italy. And I suspect that we're going to see much more of this in places like Portugal, in Greece. It's going to be a common sort of occurrence in Europe. We know that in France there are stricter laws that prevent these things from happening, but it's not you know, it's not impossible. So I would not be surprised if we see this sort of spread in the next few months if the the conditions that that exist continue.
Well, of course, one of the big links, and on a completely separate note, between Italy and Spain is this Udinese Granada connection. And Udinese have been one of the better run clubs in Italy over the last few years. They have a very, very good scouting policy. I was listening to Jonathan Wilson the other day saying they actually own rights or percentage of the rights to something like 120 players worldwide, which is incredible. And Granada are the biggest beneficiaries of this. How did they get on the opening weekend, Ravi?
Granada lost to Betis on the opening weekend, 1-0 at home. This was a rivalry that saw Granada beat Betis pretty good in the Segunda Division last season. But Betis got one on them this time. The game itself was interesting to a point that both teams had good players to take the ball up to the three-fourths of the pitch. And then they will lose their way. They run out of ideas on what to do. And it was frustrating from that point of view. It seemed like two teams were playing without a striker, but they have a lot of wingers that were taking the ball all the way to the other penalty box. In the end, Betis made a couple of changes. And Jonathan Pereira and Ruben Castro. Castro was one of their highest goal scorers last season. He scored the eventual goal that won the game for them. And then and Granada looks like they will have some trouble if they don't make any signings to continue in La Liga. Having said that, they did make a deal to get Chuku Uche from Zaragoza through Villarreal on a loan. Because Granada is in administration, they cannot buy players and pay high transfer fees. So Villarreal bought Uche for 2.5 million from Zaragoza and then loaned him to Granada. This is one of those strange deals that normally are more frequent in Italy. But we are also seeing them here because this is another way of circumventing the bankruptcy or the Ley Concursal laws, because you can't buy a player, so you make a deal with the third team, and what is the actual deal there? It could be that Udinese reduces the price of Zapata that we bought, that Villarreal bought recently, or they have some agreement for a future deal. We don't know.
This seems to be a trend that's occurring far more in Spanish football now, and you referred it to, it's happened a lot in Italy, this whole third-party ownership. And I know everyone's favorite super agent, if you like, Jorge Mendes, is involved in a lot of it.
So it's Jorge Mendes, Peter Kenyon, and Pini Sahavi. These three guys are like, they have this investment firm or like a company that buys players and owns the player rights. So Zaragoza got Roberto, and officially the deal was 8.5 million from Benfica, which is what Benfica reported to the stock market of Portugal. But Zaragoza in reality have paid, I think, 800,000 or even less, and they will just pay the wages for the player. So, and the majority of the rights of the player are owned by this group. So the idea is that they want to shop these players around, and when the value goes up, they will own the rights, so they will sell for a higher price. Whatever it is, I think what they're doing is it's a sort of like, in financial terms, it's a bit of a Ponzi scheme to me.
Edu, this kind of setup has been prevalent in South America for many years, and it's obviously banned in Britain, at least, as we saw with the Carlos Tevez incident, and then last year with Queens Park Rangers and Alejandro Forlín. Do you think Spain needs to adopt similar measures, or do you think it's for the benefit of the league that you can have a third-party ownership system?
You're absolutely right. The pioneers of this that I know were Traffic, right? That Brazilian group that...
they own half of Brazil at the moment. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, and it, again, they take advantage, especially in downturns in the economy, and that is exactly what happened in that era in Brazil. And as you know, Betis's former president and chief stockholder, Don Manuel Luis de Lopera, Ruiz de Lopera, was a man who had the scheme in place so that the club did not actually own the players. It was he who owned the rights or the companies that he held. And so I am obviously set against that. That is a scenario that can create a lot of problems. And even when you want to do things right, you can create conflicts of interest for yourself, just much like in the Mexican League. Companies own more than one team, and when they play each other, that creates an impression of impropriety. There's a lot of problems, I think, with that. The other problem that I have is a person like Quique Pina, Enrique Pina, which is the known Quique in Spain, the president of Granada. I don't really know if this guy is an agent, he's a president. What is he? Where is his interest? So those kinds of figures, I think, confuse even more the already muddled waters in Spain. And we need to clean house. And I think part of the things that need to be clean are these sort of obscure relationships in football that make absolutely no sense. Atletico Madrid has done some moving around of players that you just had us completely confused, right, Robbie? So it just muddles the water even more. And I think eventually what's going to happen, and it's where we don't want to get, is that fans are just going to abandon the game. It'll stop being fun. There won't be sentiments behind it. They cannot find a thread where you can hang on through a team's history. It's the sort of teams that are created, fabricated from one day to the next, and boom, they're gone. And so I think long term, it's bad news for football.
You mentioned Atletico Madrid. I believe they moved a player this week called Julio Cesar, who no one really knew they even owned.
Not only that, Falcao, they don't own the full rights for the player. Jorge Mendes reportedly owns up to 30% of the rights for the player. And in the same deal, they got this guy, Ruben Mikael, a Portuguese international midfielder, and they loaned him immediately to Zaragoza. So to me, it seems like this thing is getting muddier and muddier every day.
Yeah, the another phrase that, if you allow me, another phrase that Francisco Roy mentioned in that interview was, in Italiano, le dicen un casino. En España, le decimos otra cosa. And what he was saying is that in Italy, they call it a casino. In Spain, even though he didn't say it, the phrase is, it's a bordello, it's a whorehouse. So, and that's referring to the league. And unfortunately, that's the opinion that a lot of people hold. And that's not the opinion that, we should have of a professional league, of course.
Well, I don't know if you two know this, but despite the third-party arrangements in England, Manchester United actually have a tie-up with Traffic. And this isn't with Traffic itself. This is with a club that they've kind of formed to run as an academy. They don't actually compete in any of the top leagues in Brazil. They're just in, Sao Paulo State or something like that. But they...
That's right. That is the original scenario was that. They created an academy, and from that academy, they generated players.
And this is run by Carlos Alberto Pereira, who was the head coach of South Africa most recently, I think. And Man United have an agreement with them where they can pick up young talent from around South America, whether it be Brazil, Colombia, wherever, and they don't pay a thing at this point. The Desportivo Brasil, who is the club they've set up, take on the players, and then when they develop them, Man United have a fixed buyout fee for any of their group of players that they wish to take, which will be a sizable sum, but it will be a bargain if the player turns out to be the next Neymar, obviously. So I think they were somewhere around the 5 million mark, but it's a weird system.
Well, and again, given the weakness of teams in Brazil when this was created, there was, you know, the lack of money to create real youth systems. This is what they did. They created a youth system. They developed the players. And you know, it's not all bad, or in theory, it doesn't have to be all bad, right? You give young men an opportunity to develop as players. You take them out of the streets, out of the favelas. So these things could be created in a positive way. But again, you know, if the intent was to generate goodwill and help people, which is, of course, it's always not the case, right? And if it becomes only a money-making sort of scenario, then you always have shenanigans that are associated with these kinds of things. So, you know, we don't want to just denounce the whole thing necessarily, but I think what ends up happening, and specifically, for example, with Betis, you know, was shenanigans. You know, ended up being basically what Robbie was saying, a Ponzi scheme.
So, of course, the other talking point that's happened with the concerning Spanish football since the last time we spoke, guys, is the Champions League groups and Ravi, a tough draw for Villarreal.
Yes, right out of the bat, Group A, I was looking at following the draw, and I couldn't believe they kept adding. When they first added Man City, I said, okay, no kidding, we are not going to get Napoli in the fourth round or the fourth pot. And there you go. So it's a hard group. There is no way around it. And it's hard for all four teams. While Manchester City definitely is the team that has the most depth, especially after adding Kun Agüero and also Samir Nasri. But the good thing is only 11 can play at a time. And you have to take your chances against them if you're a team like Villarreal. I think, you know, I can talk from VRL perspective. The big challenge for them is they are going to miss Borja Valero for at least two games. So UEFA has banned him for three for that headbutt in the second leg against Odense. It was a very stupid move, but it's going to hurt us a lot. They're going to appeal it. So I think if the appeal goes well, they might reduce it to two games. But I don't see that happening with any high hopes. If it happens, great, but either way, we're going to miss him for at least two games. And that's the kind of player that would make a difference against a team like Bayern München, who are very good on the wings, especially with Robin and Ribéry, have a suspect defense, and they're decent in midfield. I mean, they're good to decent, but I think Villarreal midfield with Borja Valero would have been better. And with Borja Valero, Villarreal would have been able to keep the possession so that we won't be vulnerable to the attacks of Robin and Ribéry.
Obviously, Villarreal and Napoli and Bayern Munich, from listening to your podcast and also the Bundesliga Fanatic podcast, they're all kind of very worried about ending up as the weakest team in the group, which isn't a sense I'm getting from Man City fans. But all four teams in this group will know the importance of particularly the home games, right?
Yes, I think in case... So I was doing some analysis for the Villarreal podcast about this, how can Villarreal qualify. I think this game, it's not only the home games. I think you have to mark an opponent where you're going to get at least 4 or 6 points against. I think teams will look at either, if I'm Villarreal, I'll probably look at Napoli, who we beat them last year in the Europa League, one of the rounds. And you look at them and say, okay, they're going to go first play in Manchester City, and they haven't played a league game yet. They got thrashed by Barcelona in that Gamper game, which was a friendly. So they won't have a match fitness or match practice a lot before they play. They will have one game, one Serie A game next weekend if they play it, and then they go play Manchester City in Manchester. If they're going to lose that game big, then the second game for Villarreal is against them in Napoli. And for Villarreal, if they have to have any chance of qualifying, they have to get points out of that game. And so every game will be like a game of like an elimination game in this round, because you have to get as many points as possible. In the end, it might so happen that teams take so many points of each other that you could qualify from this group with 8 points, because there could be 11, 8, 7, 6 points, as you know. Well, that's how the teams might end up. So it's going to be like, for Villarreal, they're playing first home game, 2 away games, and then home, away, home. They'll end up with Napoli at home. So from my calculations, you know, optimistic and a fan of Villarreal calculations, I think if we come to the last game with a chance to qualify, which is Napoli at home, I think we'll qualify.
Edu, how do you see this group ending up? Obviously, you're slightly more objective position than Ravi on this one.
Well, I think more than the other teams, I would be more concerned about Villarreal's fitness. From the match that we saw against Barcelona, I think they need to do some work on their back four, and that's going to be a key factor. Napoli saw last year that they're a very competitive team, very good players. So they should be a difficult team. Bayern, it's more of a guessing game. If Robben is not around, they're going to depend a lot on Mario Gomez and his you know, how he feels in those games. If he's playing well, when he plays well, I think they're a tough matchup, because they have other players that can really take advantage of how much room he takes up on the field. And so I think in other years I would be a lot more comfortable with Villarreal. Losing a player like Santi Cazorla is not going to be easy for them. He really was the key to that team. It allows, I think, Rossi to do a lot of things. I'm disappointed also with the play of Nilmar, and let's see if Marco Senna can recover some of his dominance, and that's going to be key for Villarreal, and the other groups. I think the most sort of interesting thing is that Real Madrid seems to be tied at the hip with Lyon, Olympique, right? So this is, I think, the fourth year in a row that they're matched in a group. So that's curious how these things end up being. But other than that, I'm looking forward to seeing some of these matchups. Barcelona has a match against Milan. Of course, they're not at their best, but they're not an easy team to beat at home. So it should be interesting. And I think you had mentioned, Chris, that you were very curious to see I think City, how they do. And that's a team that we haven't talked about a lot. And I'm very keen on them. I think they are a very, very powerful team. And this is a team to me could make it all the way to the final.
Well, at this point, I'm gonna bring in the Elastico founder. Rio, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
You're a big fan of City this season, right, Rio?
I am, yeah. I think they're playing very impressively right now. You know, I think the transition from last year, the boring City team that was very impressive defensively, but, you know, concerns about their attacking prowess, that seems to have gone away, at least early on in the season. And certainly the moves over the summer for Aguero and Nasri have certainly helped, and Dzeko coming into form. So yeah, I think they're playing impressively right now, and I don't think they should be overlooked in the Champions League this year.
So if we say that this group's going to be very tough for all four teams, and that Real Madrid and Barcelona should progress quite easily from their groups, the other Spanish team involved are, of course, Valencia, who are in with Chelsea, Bayer Leverkusen, and Genk. Ravi, how do you see Valencia getting on in that group?
Well, I think Valencia has a group that it's not too hard, too easy. they are capable of beating Bayer Leverkusen and Genk, as long as their coach Emery doesn't try some cute tricks with the formations. He usually has to play with them a little bit over the season. If he just try to go get 3 points against all those in those four games, I think they will win. And even the Chelsea game at home won't be easy for Chelsea. So I think Valencia has got a draw where if they can play to their level, they can easily make it.
Edu, do you think Leverkusen can maybe produce a shock for one of the bigger two names in the group?
I don't know if they're at that level that they used to be. In other years, I would give them a better chance. I think it's certainly a possibility. You know, football is a very, very difficult game to really understand sometimes. But I think on paper, Chelsea and Valencia, you know, are the two strongest sides here in that order. And I would expect that to play out, you know, over a group play. I think in a particular match they could surprise somebody. But I think as a group plays out, I think that's the way the dominoes are going to fall.
Well, and we've seen it so often in the Champions League that winning the group is not essential, but very important for the next round. You get a much tougher tie in many cases if you come second, as Arsenal have found last year when they ended up with Barcelona in the second round. Rio, do you think Chelsea will be cautious when they approach, say, Valencia, and knowing that they ideally need a first-place finish?
I think maybe in seasons past they would be, but I think the Villas-Boas style is very much an attack-minded one. That's something that Roman Abramovich really wanted to see, and I think that is something that this coach, you know, that's his philosophy is getting the goals. It's not preventing goals. So I think Chelsea will look, you know, to score goals home and away. And to get the 3 points, I don't think we will see very, very much negative tactics from them. But one thing I'd like to ask Edu and Ravi as La Liga watchers, your take on Juan Mata and what he can offer Chelsea, and also, you know, how much weaker is Valencia without him?
Well, I think Juan Mata is a big hole to fill for Valencia. They have made good signings like Pablo Piatti and Sergio Canales to fill his role. And they will definitely change a little bit without Mata. So now the thing is how soon these two new players can gel into the formation and start working at an optimum level. I think that is the big question mark. As long as they can get that going, they've replaced Mata with, if not equally, very closely, well-talented players. But compared to last year, they seem to have a weakness in defense this year. Even though it was just one league game, we saw that they had trouble against Racing on week one, but they have tried to address it by signing Victor Ruiz from Espanyol/Napoli last week. So I think they have addressed all the holes. I think right now the question for Valencia is how they work, how the new players would fit into a Mata-less Valencia.
And I think, Rio, that Mata is much more of a plus at Chelsea than a minus at Valencia. I think he's a type of player, and I'm a big Mata supporter. I think his football is really, really good and very subtle, and it's more of a player for Barcelona. You know, he could fit in perfectly there, and I think he will add something to Chelsea that they've not had, that subtlety, that play between lines. And if Drogba is able to get his form back, if Torres is able to get his form back, and even with Anelka, I think those are players that he will make so much better, because he's such a smart player, and he's going to make their life a lot easier. And his success will also come from their success. So in that sense, I think it's a great, great addition to Chelsea. I think it's a very smart move on their part. If they want to play attacking football, they needed a player like that, a player to take advantage of spaces, to know how to move. And I think a player who has big time experience, and he's not going to shy away from the top level competition. So I think it's a huge plus for Chelsea. I think that his role in Valencia without Villa, without a top goal scorer, was never going to be utilized to its fullest. So I think kudos to Chelsea.
Well, I think you've just made my life a lot worse. I'm going to hear about Guamata far more from Rio now. He's already in love with the guy. So. All right, so in part two of the show, we have Robert Sweeney, whose Santa Polota blog focuses on a lot of tactical side of the game, and he's going to be discussing the Brazilian Championship with us. And then, Edu, I believe you're coming back for our Player of the Week segment, where you're going to discuss a prodigious striker in Brazil at the moment.
Yes, a player that I think we're also enamored of, and I hope that you're going to enjoy it. Should we tell them now, or should we keep it a secret?
I'll let you tell them now.
Okay, Leandro Damião, the young striker that is really taking Brazil by storm.
All right, well, thank you, guys, and Edu, we'll see you later in the show.
Okay, guys, talk to you soon.
So I'm joined here with Robert Sweeney from Santa Polota website. You can find him on Twitter, at Santa Polota. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And you're here to discuss the Brazilian Championship. The big story, obviously, is Ronaldinho and Flamengo. How do you think they've been getting on this year?
Well, it's particularly well, actually, to the point where he's earned himself a call-up to the national team. I don't know where the credit lies with it. I think partly it has to do with the player himself. He seems to be happy in his personal life. But at the same time, he is showing great dedication. I mean, he looks physically in great form. And now, I'm not saying that he's tearing past players, he's dribbling past players, but he looks more mobile, he's looking for the ball. He seems to have recaptured a degree of spontaneity about him as well. And credit also must go to Flamengo and to the coach, Vanderlei Luxemburgo, because he has put in place a system which compensates for Ronaldinho's shortcomings, let's say.
He's come a long way since the start of the season, when he did look slow, and Flamengo had even set up a hotline for fans to call in when they saw him out partying. It was to that extent that he was focused on his social life more than his football.
Yeah, but you know, in a sense, I could hardly blame. I mean, I find it hard to blame him in terms of not being able to motivate himself to face some sides. Okay, you would say, well, he's the highest paid player in Brazil. I mean, he should motivate himself for every single game, no matter against which side, for reasons of professionalism. But the fact was that at the beginning of the year in the Carioca Championship, he was playing sides like Cabo Friense, provincial sides in the absurd Brazilian state championship system, which is an absolute abomination, in my opinion. But I think only now Ronaldinho was starting to, only when the Brazilian championship took off did Ronaldinho really begin to feel motivated and excited at the prospect of the players he was playing against. Because let's face it, both you and I know that the Brazilian championship is of a considerably high quality, and it's while overall it cannot be compared to the main principal European leagues in terms of quality, it certainly is more competitive than any of them. And I think that this, and perhaps partly I might be going delving a bit too much into psychology, but the fact that Neymar and other such players have been coming so prominent and almost earning as much money as Europe-based Brazilian players might have sort of piqued his interest, might have piqued Ronaldinho's interest. You know, say, well, I'm the king, you know, I'm the reigning best player in Brazil, and I think he stepped up his game as a result.
Well, that was one of the curious things, was the turning point in Ronaldinho's season actually seemed to be that matchup with Santos. It was as if Neymar's wonder goal early in that game, when Santos went, I think, 2 or 3-0 up, that was the moment when Ronaldinho suddenly thought, right, I'm going to turn it on now. Ever since, he's been probably the best player in the league.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, his quality is absurd. And it makes you sad, in a sense, to think that the past, say, 3 years, or perhaps even his final three or four seasons in Europe, when he was, you know, patently unmotivated, they could have gone better. I mean, if he had played at this level, or perhaps even better, I mean, we could still have been talking about one of the top 10 players in the world, you know? Now, I don't honestly believe Ronaldinho will ever get back to that level, or even close to it, but, you know, there's no way you can say that he's a washed-out footballer, or that he's gone to Brazil for a golden retirement. I mean, he has ignited the league. He's been the catalyst for Flamengo's title challenge, and he's enjoyable to watch. You know, that's a big thing. He pulls in the audiences.
At this moment, then, I want to get your opinion on another, shall we say, star who's now been labelled washed up, Kaká. He scored on the opening day of the Spanish league last week. He hopefully will get some more injury-free game time with Real Madrid. Is there an opportunity for him to get back in the Seleção?
To enter the Brazilian national team, you know, I really don't know. A lot of it could depend on Ganso. You would imagine that if Mano Menezes were to call up Kaká, it would be in place of somebody like Ganso. Or perhaps Manu could decorate this. Perhaps he could sell such a gesture as an attempt to offer Ganso some tutelage, you know. But then again, part of me thinks that that would be a very logical proposition when you consider that they are such different players. You know, Kaká being that vertical kind of very goal-scoring orientated attacking midfielder. Ganso being more about playing static in between the lines and drawing people onto him and releasing the ball for others. I personally would call up Kaká to the national team, but I think I would make it clear to him that he should try and force an exit from Madrid. I think for the sake of his talent, for justifying, doing justice to his own talent, and even for the sake of football fans everywhere, we need to see. The guy is not yet 30. He's 29 years old, and he still has a lot of football left to give. It would be a shame to lose him. It would be a shame for him to fade into a footnote, almost.
Well, as you said, the next generation that has been discussed is obviously the trio that are in the national team right now, and that's Neymar, Ganso, and Lucas Moura. And Neymar and Ganso are both at Santos. They won the Libertadores in style earlier this season. They were undisputedly the best team in Brazil at that point. Now we're coming into the league season, and Santos are languishing in 13th place at the moment, and they don't even have the excuse of still having games in hand now. Well, what's going on there? I mean, Ganso hasn't been the same player since that final, really.
Yeah, Ganso. It's curious because of the two stars, of Neymar and Ganso, Ganso has always been the one who was most eager to move on, to force a move to Europe. He claimed, sources close to him seemed to intimate that it was what was forcing him to, what was inducing him to make this move, to seek this move, was the fact that he wasn't getting the same financial benefits as Neymar. He wasn't being offered the same perks, the same contract. Okay, they offered him a new contract, I believe, an extension, a wage increase, but still it doesn't seem to be enough. Now, I do think that perhaps Ganso's game is languishing here in Brazil. I mean, he's really not doing anything in the sense that Neymar is kind of wasting his time. Let's be honest at this point. Neymar is the best player in the league. I mean, I still believe he's more talented than Ronaldinho at the moment, and he's proving it. You know, he's absurdly good. He's nothing left to prove in this league. With Ganso, I think he could still perform well in this league, but I think his mentality is already in Europe, whereas when Neymar wants to stay, for emotional reasons, he seems to have a greater attachment to Santos, you know? With Ganso, I think he knows that his game is actually going backwards. I think he knows that, and that every minute he spends, he's just wasting his time.
Well, I think Ganso, playing that number 10 role that's so integral to most of Brazilian football that you see. Just for listeners who don't watch Brazilian football, there's a massive gap between the defensive line and the midfield in Brazilian football, and the number 10 just kind of sits in that space. And then we saw in the Copa America, he didn't have that space. But whereas others, more experienced players, should we say, might go looking for it, he didn't. He just kind of stood around waiting for the space to appear. And that's why I think Ganso needs the move to Europe, to develop his positional awareness, if you like.
Yeah, and I don't know if you agree with me, Chris, but I cannot envisage Ganso playing in Europe as a number 10. In other words, I cannot see him as that player between the lines. I think he will have to adopt to a slightly more Xavi, Iniesta type role, you know, like a midfield playmaker.
Could you see him as a Pirlo, a deep-lying passing midfielder?
Ideally, I would. Although, that would be a huge cultural shock for him, because in Brazil, players like Ganso are not played, never, let alone played in midfield. They're not even played behind the midfield. You know what I mean? They are not afforded that kind of role. I think, you know, that would be... I think Ganso himself might even be opposed to that. I think it's a great kind of... It's a great challenge to convince a South American number 10 that his game will not suffer if you alter his position. It almost seems there's something sacrosanct about the role. But he might think, oh, but I won't be able to thread through so many final balls, you know, provide so many assists. But, you know, I think nobody's in doubt that Pirlo is a better player for having made the move, made that transition from the front of the midfield to the back of the midfield. I would like to see Ganso there because I think a relative lack of mobility is not such an issue.
This is why me and Rio, when we were discussing earlier in the summer, were convinced that the PSG move that was seemingly on the table was a great move for Ganso because it wouldn't have the pressure of being at the highest level. Because to me, at the moment, if he moved to a Real Madrid, a Barcelona, a AC Milan, the pressure would be huge, and his game isn't quite there yet.
Exactly, and the danger is he could end up as a sort of a Fernando Gago figure who arrived at huge fanfare. I know they played in different positions and they have a different style, but Gago is considered, at the top level, is considered something of a joke nowadays. But, you know, when this guy arrived, he was labelled as the new Fernando Redondo. And you just wonder that if Gago had gone to a slightly smaller club or as a sort of a nouveau riche club, as you were saying, like with new petrodollar backing, it might be in a slightly less demanding league. It might have been easier for him to make that transition. You know, I think Cruyff and his school of football at Barcelona, they had an expression in terms of the youth team progression. They called it quemar etapas, you know, not to burn your respective phases. In other words, they'd never wanted a young, gifted player to be promoted too soon to a senior team, lest he not go through the evolutionary process, the growing pains that were necessary to fully form him. And I think it's the same in terms of transferring from one league, from one continent to another. You know, it's great if you can have that step up, you know? And, you know, is there any coincidence that perhaps, in my opinion, the most effective Brazilian performer in over the past decade in European football was Deco, who almost, you know, came from obscurity in a very superficial sense. You know, Porto were by no means a superficial club, but before he arrived at Porto, Deco was playing for a lot more modest Portuguese outfits, and we saw how he, and surely when Deco left Corinthians in Brazil, and I think he was rejected by them, and he was not very well considered. He was considered something. I'm sure he was, you know, that kind of player who demanded that the ball always come to him, and he was sort of the diva of the team. And yet, what a spectacular player he became. He became like the prototype of the modern playmaker who also defends and is very collective-minded. And I would just wonder if Ganso could have made a move like that. That would have been terrific.
Well, of course, now we're seeing in the Brazilian Championship, for a long time we thought it would just be a Corinthians-Flamengo-Sao Paulo shootout. But the Under-20 World Cup has put pay, seemingly, to Sao Paulo's challenge. They've dropped back a bit with the loss of Casemiro, and then they had Lucas at the Copa America. So yeah, They've dropped back slightly. But this has let Botafogo and Vasco da Gama, two of the smaller Rio de Janeiro sides, well, not smaller, but they're still massive clubs. As you were saying, there's about 12 massive clubs in Brazil who are of fairly equal standing. And here we've got players like Alcorcon, who doesn't have the reputation of, say, Akanso, who's about the same age. I think they're both 21. And he's looked fantastic this season.
Yeah, he has. Botafogo are... It's very strange. I mean, just on the merits of their squad, they have no right to be competing for this championship. I mean, I would often fear if Elkerson were to get injured, what would happen to Botafogo? And that is my concern. I honestly don't think that they will sustain the challenge. Whereas, say, São Paulo, who have a massive squad, even Corinthians, they could turn it around, you know? But it is curious that the Carioca clubs are doing so well in general, except as you mentioned earlier, Fluminense, who are not doing well, who seem to be suffering from a hangover post the 2010 championship, which is quite normal in Brazil. It's quite a common occurrence. Botafogo, though, I can't see them sustaining a challenge until the end of the year.
Well, Vasco is very similar. They have a very good first team, shall we say, but past that, there's not much depth. But it's interesting you mentioned, so we had Fluminense and Cruzeiro first and second last year, as well as Internacional won the Libertadores in about October. And if we look at their places in the league now, they're in 8th, 10th, and 11th place. And this is a particular feature of Brazilian football, that you're not guaranteed to maintain your position from one year to the next. Obviously, the vultures come circling and you lose half your team with any success.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think there are two circumstances in which a club's going to suffer. For example, in the case of Cruzeiro and Fluminense, it was patently the case of the squad being gutted, as you were saying, you know, a fire sale pretty much. Well, in global terms, it's a fire sale. In terms of the other side, such as Internacional and Santos, I think it's more of a hangover effect. The fact that you have more or less 4 months in between the end of Libertadores, perhaps even five, and the beginning of the World Club Championship. This is a time when a team feels who wins Libertadores feels itself supreme. They're the best team in South America. So why should they force themselves in the Brazilian championship? You know, I'm sure there must be some sort of psychological device whereby the players just switch off. They feel like they've won everything for the time being. The World Club Championship could not come quicker. It could not come sooner for those teams, you know?
Well, I think if you look at Santos, for example, they've already sold Danilo and Alexandro to Porto. Danilo is hanging on till after the Club World Cup, then he's going. There's fairly heavy rumours of Neymar going to Real Madrid in January, and I haven't heard so much of that recently, but that was the talk for a lot of the summer. So for Santos, that World Club Cup has been the focus of everything since they won the Libertadores, and the advertising campaign started immediately. The players were being sold for after the event already, and it just seems that the league is totally unimportant now. But then the fear of relegation is going to start catching up with them at some point.
Yeah, although I don't think they will get relegated. I think their quality is too good. I mean, unlike sides like Inter, Fluminense, in recent years, Santos have not sold their best players. They've sold very good players since. I think Alexandre was one guy I think they sold. But they have not actually gone so far as to destroy the original winning squad. And they still have an excellent coach, in my opinion. It's very interesting to listen to Muricy Ramalho's comments on what are his interpretations of Santos's woes, and he believes that it's all to do with the sort of courting of Neymar and Ganso and the sort of inevitability that they will go. I think almost in a bizarre way, Muricy, for the purposes of the Brazilian championship, Muricy would prefer if Neymar and Ganso were already out of the squad And then, you know, the team had been remodeled and rebuilt so that he could face this this Brazilian championship and challenge for the title, qualify for Libertadores, you name it. But like we say, Santos are in this sort of twilight zone now, this bizarre thing where they're hanging around waiting for one or two games at the end of the year. And they're the only, it's almost like the only two games which Ganso and Neymar should lower themselves to play for, you know.
You mentioned before the show that you wanted to talk about the two Gaúcho teams, which is Internacional and Grêmio. For those who aren't so familiar, again, once more, Brazil is very much state-orientated, which is why you have the state championships. And the two biggest teams from that region are, by a mile, Internacional and Grêmio, both from Porto Alegre, right?
Yeah, exactly. But neither team has been enjoying much success in recent months. I mean, Inter have generally been enjoying a stronger, I would say, have enjoyed a stronger period over the last few years. Although Grêmio have been, Grêmio's case has been one of disappointment, really. They never have reached the heights of the Scolari years of the mid to late 90s.
They're lying in 17th at the moment. If you think over the last 10, 15 years, the players they've produced, I was discussing this with someone the other day, Grêmio has had Ronaldinho, Anderson, Lucas Leiva, Douglas Costa all come through the ranks, and
yeah,
they've all been sold, and there's no, the money hasn't really been used wisely.
Exactly. Grêmio's great misfortune has been that it has had club directors who do not know how to make contracts, who do not know how to sell. I mean, to give you an example, last year in the 2010 championship, at the beginning, Grêmio were suffering from mediocre form. Then that mediocre form became very poor and threatening. Then they hired Renato Gaúcho. This was, sorry, at the tail end of 2009. Under Renato Gaúcho, the tail end of 2010, under Renato, the former idol, an ex-winger who played for Grêmio, they completely recovered. They turned around with a squad that was not that impressive, but with some outstanding individual performances, and particularly with Jonas, who currently plays for Valencia, and who became, I think, the joint top scorer of the Brazilian championship, if I'm not mistaken. But in any case, somehow at the beginning of this year, Grêmio lost Jonas for peanuts because they had somehow overlooked the possibility that, hey, this guy's a decent player. Perhaps
he had
a
buyout clause, correct?
There was a buyout clause which Grêmio could have chosen to renew. Grêmio could have offered him an extended and improved contract, which they should have if they had any respect or any notion about the player's ability. But they did not. And then Valencia came in, and I think they paid him for...
Or 2 million, right? Something around the 1 to 2 million mark.
Yeah, it certainly didn't go above 4 million reais, 4 million reals in the Brazilian currency. And we have to bear in consideration that Grêmio would see very little of that, perhaps not even half of that amount. Half of that would go to the third party ownership, which is more common here in Brazil. So it was an absurd, catastrophic for Grêmio to lose their one differential player and not even to generate enough funds from him. You know, they devalued him, but they have had a long history of that. Gremistas are still very bitter about the manner in which Ronaldinho Gaúcho left at the beginning of the last decade to go to Paris Saint-Germain. The truth is, we probably never know exactly what went on. It's true that Ronaldinho Gaúcho has something of an avaricious reputation. Assis, his brother, another former player whose career was cut short by injury. But it seems that Grêmio could have kept Ronaldinho for a while longer had they made an improved contract, but they didn't. So Grêmio have this kind of bizarre situation where they seem to create great talents, but never are able to harness those talents either to serve the team through their efforts on the field, nor generate enough funds which would correspond to the true value of these great players.
Well, Robert, it's been great talking to you again, and I hope our listeners have learned something about the Brazilian Championship from this chat. The likes of Neymar, Ganso, Leandro Damião of Internacional, who's scoring for fun this year, and I'll discuss that with Edu in the show also. They're the names who are going to light up Brazilian football for the next few years. And luckily for Brazilian viewers, they're still in the championship. So anyone who's in any doubt should be tuning in this season, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's fantastic at times. You can see all styles of football being played at all kind of tempos. Sometimes you see frenetic games. It's a fiercely competitive championship with outstanding talent. And you know, in a very succinct sense, you are watching the players who will be playing at your European club tomorrow, in a way. It's a shame to package it like that, but that's the reality. That's the way it is.
Well, thanks a lot, Robert. It's been great talking to you again, and we'll have you on again soon.
Oh, great. It's been a pleasure being on board, Chris. Thanks.
So in this final section of the podcast, we're going to continue our Player of the Week feature from last week. And this week, we've come to a consensus that our Player of the Week is going to be Leandro Damião. He's in the Brazil squad for Monday's encounter with Ghana. And he's been the top goal scorer in Brazil in 2011. Edu, I know you're one person who's been very impressed with Damião this year.
I have, Chris. Again, thanks for having us on. I enjoy always being on and talking to you, and in this section specifically, it's one of the things that I like to do is to focus on a player, Leandro Damião da Silva dos Santos, born in Brazil, of course, 22nd of July of 1989, which makes him only 22 years of age. And I think probably that is one of the most attractive things about this, you know, player, the youth. A 1.87 meters, 6'2", more or less, right? A right-footer player. All those things jump at you when you see him physically. He a talented player, gifted, right? Has size, has speed, and finishing. So that when you see that on a soccer pitch, well, of course you're always interested in and want to know how far this player can go with the Brazilian national team and perhaps beyond.
Well, yeah, and in 2011, he scored 33 goals in 41 games, which is incredible. And that's not just in domestic games. He's been scoring in the continental competitions as well. And he's got 9 goals in his last 10 games, which has earned him this recall to the Brazilian squad. And I remember we were talking recently, and you were comparing him to Luis Fabiano in style.
Yeah, I asked a question and said, does he remind you of Luis Fabiano? I would not categorically say that they're exactly alike, but there are things that remind me. You know, size and skill and finishing, you put those three things together, and to me, Luis Fabiano comes to mind. And certainly, Leandro is a player that... For me, obviously, I have some interest. I see him trying to, you know, where can I fit this player in Europe? I'm very egoistic in that sense that I get to see probably more of European football than I do of Brasileirão, and I think also better competition. So I'm trying to fit him in Europe already. See what could be a good fit for him, and of course, always comes to mind whether the quality is good enough to play at the highest level. And I'm starting to become a believer, Chris. I think he does have the tools to be successful anywhere you put him.
Well, like you, I was a bit of a doubter at first because obviously coming into the Brasileirão season, he'd done very well in the state championships and at the end of last season. But the state championships, as we all know, aren't always the best, particularly in the Gaúcho competition. There's the two big teams. There's a handful of others who are decent, but there's some pretty poor sides in there. So it's easy to boost your goal-scoring tally. But he's really continued it, and scoring against the best teams as well. He scored 3 goals in 2 games in the Recopa against last year's Copa Sudamericana champions, Independiente. And he also he scored against Flamengo. He scored against Santos, I think. He scored against the top sides in Brazil. And not just easy goals either. There's an overhead kicks in there. There's goals where he's beaten defenders and run past them. There's all sorts of goals, headers, left foot, right foot.
What makes them so attractive, right? The the variety of the finishes, and also Chris, he seems to be able to create some chances for players around him as well. He has some, I think, 4 assists in the Brasileirão, which I think it's also something that we could compare to Luis Fabiano, right? It's not only him. He can also create if he chooses. So those things make him very, very attractive, I think.
Well, and it's interesting because he does have that side, but he also, there is of the selfish streak you do want to see in your number 9 as well. Because he's had the most shots in the league. I think he's had 77 shots in 18 games, which is 4-5 shots a game. That's an impressive tally for a lone striker, as he often is. And well, I think in Brazil at the moment, there's a definite shortage of quality number 9s, and there's going to be a lot of expectation on his shoulder.
I think you're absolutely right. You want that number 9 to be a guy who wants to score. But if you look at those numbers of shots and you look at the number of goals, that becomes even more impressive, right? Because the quality of the finish, the finishing is really, really high. So when you have that combination, it's really powerful that you have a guy who wants to create shots for himself. But when he does get the shots off, they're going in. So I think, again, that this is a player that we're going to have to keep an eye on and could prove very, very important for Brazil as an option for their national squad to have a player that can be a reference player up front, take up some space and allow players like Robinho at this point in their career, or Pato, or Ganso, and of course our the player that everybody, Neymar, that everybody of course has on the tip of their tongue. Those players have a lot more freedom when they get a player like this up front, right? That attracts so much attention. So I think for Brazil, it's good news, and I am hoping that we're going to get to see him in a top side in Europe in the next year or so.
Well, he's been heavily linked with Tottenham for a while now.
Well, yeah. my grandmother has been heavily linked to Tottenham, but Chris, he hasn't been with us for quite a while.
That's true. That's, everyone is linked to Tottenham, including, as we saw last week, Kaká. And
That's right. So, and we do wish, of course, the Spurs the best, and we want them to get a player that fits that side and makes them competitive. It's a team that I like, had some sympathy for, and so we wish them the best. But and this might be a good fit for them, but it's hard to tell. The Brazilian economy is much stronger than it's been in the last, of course, 2 decades, and we don't see the exodus that we were seeing in past years. Teams are able to keep players longer, so it'll be interesting to see, you know, when somebody makes a real hard push for Leandro.
Well, on Monday, Brazil take on Ghana at Craven Cottage. I'll be there reporting for the Elastico. So hopefully then we'll have the chance to see Leandro Damião in the shirt of the Brazilian national team. Right, that's it for this week's podcast. My thanks to Edu and to Ravi, and also to Robert Sweeney, who we had on in the middle. They're all on Twitter. I'll be publishing their Twitter accounts on the Elastico and on the podcast page. Please add them. Please follow them. And thanks for helping us out at such short notice. And to all you guys, we'll be back next week.
So long, folks.